KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
On the 14th day of April of 1935, there struck the worst of dust storms that ever filled the sky. You could see that dust storm coming, the cloud looked death-like black, and through our mighty nation it left a dreadful track.
This is one of the worst sustained environmental disasters in American history. It's not something that happens in just one year. It's not something that just lasts for 3 or 4 years. It's a decade. Because of the combination of extreme drought and extreme high temperatures, this is the worst 10-year period in recorded history on the plains.
We saw outside our window where wheat fields they had grown was now...
It's Woody Guthrie singing about the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. The destruction of Hurricane Sandy reminds us how quickly natural disasters change our lives and how ecological disasters can have some impact on politics as well. Ken Burns has made a documentary highlighting this story, the Dust Bowl. It ran last night. It runs tonight. Tim Egan, who, of course, wrote his award-winning book, The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl. Well, he's a big part of that. He's a big part of that documentary. And he's in to talk about it. Good to see you again.
Great to be with you.
You know, I want to talk about the ecological disaster, and I'm going to go full circle here because you were saying you flew out from the East Coast last night and you could see that environmental disaster on the ground.
A couple of days ago. Actually, yeah, when your plane circles around before it lands in New York, they come low and you can see that a huge part of the Jersey Shore just swamped. The beach is gone. I mean, the berms are knocked down and you see just row after row after row for houses that were surviving barely above sea level. I mean, they had a berm. They were a few feet above sea level. And it looks like how you imagined Holland 200 years ago. And people forget, I mean, it's amazing how that storm so changed the conversation and so brought home the idea, oh, rising seas can have an effect since something like 3/4 of all people live at or near sea level.
Oh, yeah, government. All right, so I want to come back to that. But one of the things that I was struck, and I remember, again, in reading your book and struck by looking at different clips from this series, is that, as we heard, this was an environmental disaster, and it was not entirely man-caused, but man's use of the land added to the destruction.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think has been a hard to change in terms of the historical view of the Dust Bowl. It is changing. Ken Burns arrived at the same conclusion as I did, as anyone who's looked at this thing honestly. It wasn't a natural disaster because, Steve, we've always had droughts in the Southern Plains. We've always had high winds. The only thing missing in this case was they'd ripped up all the grass. So it was a man-caused disaster that changed the climate.
There's a clip from this. I want to just – a little quick clip from this because people were ecstatic to be in the Midwest because they thought they had come to the promised land.
We had the best crop that we had had in 1929, and everything was looking up.
I saw the whole country transformed in the sunset glow. All the brown prairie turned to gold.
Right? When you were working on The Worst Hard Time, that was what you encountered as well, right?
Yeah, same thing. What's amazing is there are people still alive who saw the whole arc from, you know, basically the homesteading. They lived in sod houses to the extraordinary rise in wheat prices, which gave rise to prosperity. That was caused by World War I and Part II, to the earth turning on them, to now living out their final years in their 90s. And they did describe it as this Whitman-esque view of the native prairie grass offering promise. And then the first few years, the rains came. This is dryland wheat. So this crop they're growing is dependent on rain in an area that gets 20 inches or so, which is right about at the margin. And they lied about, I mean, they said the trains were causing rain to come. That was the concussive theory that first linked to Napoleon. They said that civilization itself, the act of breaking the sod would cause more rain to fall. So they diluted themselves during the wet years, as people do. I mean, there were good years.
Yeah. You know, I'm struck by how one of the projects that rise out of this disaster was to capture the Columbia and irrigate land that also can't sustain the kind of agriculture that we're asking it to sustain without the technology involved.
It's one of the greatest sort of side things of the Dust Bowl. Most people in the Northwest don't know that the Columbia was initially dammed by the federal government to provide a refuge for the diaspora fleeing another part of America, which we'd ruined. Roosevelt's name for the land in the inland Columbia region was called the Planned Promised Land. That was the uppercase proper name for it.
Is that right?
The Moses Lake area, all the reclaimed area now that grows potatoes for McDonald's to make French fries in. That was where the Okies would go. They said, we'll back up this river. We'll have endless water. We'll throw it onto this dry scab land, and it'll be 2 million acres of Planned Promised Land.
All right, so here's this other clip from this documentary that Ken Burns did, the Dust Bowl, which is about what started happening.
We saw this cloud coming in, black dirt. And I'll never forget my grandmother. She said, "You kids run and get together. The end of the world's coming."
I mean, that's just frightening. And we've seen those images, but these people lived it. They had to breathe it or try to.
And it killed them. I mean, we both made the point that it not only killed the land, it started killing their children. They died of dust pneumonia, which is a version of silicosis. Basically, these fine dust particles get in, and they basically smothered them. Some of the really sad things to read were about these accounts of these animals dying. And then they'd go cut them open, and they'd find they literally smothered to death. So, I mean, it's an important point here that these people didn't need latter-day environmentalists or historians to come along and say, "You screwed up." They knew in their heart, and they often gave it a biblical reference, or they often gave it a, you know, God is punishing us. They saw an anthropomorphized effect, but they knew they had pushed nature to its extreme.
You know, I remember in reading the book and us talking about it, and again in this documentary, people stayed.
Yeah.
And that was what was amazing in the story you wrote, that you talked to people who stayed.
Well, you don't know you're in the middle of something when you're in the middle of something. They had never seen anything like this. They had no institutional memory. This land was a tabula rasa in 1900. They'd moved all the Indians out of there. There was nobody living there. So, you know, settlement was all of 30 years. They had nothing to go back on. So in 1935, when this thing had raged for almost 4 years, they thought, well, this is unprecedented, but it has to end next spring. And the parallel to our day is, what do we know if we're in year one of 200 years of climate change? I mean, you just, it's so easy for us. And then people make the historical mistake of looking back and thinking, why didn't those idiots know? You just don't know when you're in the middle of it.
All right. So that brings me to this question. All right, actually, first, let's do it this way. So FDR is thinking about these things, right? And FDR as president, he's trying to address what's happening and what his policies should be. Here's a little bit of a fireside chat.
"I shall never forget the fields of wheat, so blasted by heat that they cannot be harvested. I shall never forget field after field of corn, stunted, earless, stripped of leaves. For what the sun left, the grasshoppers took. I saw brown pastures that would not keep a cow on 50 acres. Yet I would not have you think for a single minute that there is permanent disaster in these drought regions, or that the picture I saw meant depopulating these areas. No cracked earth, no blistering sun, no burning wind, no grasshoppers are a permanent match for the indomitable American farmers and stockmen and their wives and children who have carried on through desperate days and inspire us with their self-reliance, their tenacity, and their courage."
All right, Tim Egan, I can hear Barack Obama in a reelected, perhaps emboldened Barack Obama, who did at least mention climate change in his acceptance speech, giving a similar talk. Politically, are we at a cusp here?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of interesting things in that speech, which is a great one. I'm glad you used that clip. First of all, hearing that Upper Hudson accent, no grasshoppers. The Roosevelt swore that he was not going to have a single part of America be emptied out on his watch. And this amounted to a monumental acknowledgement of failure.
Mm-hmm.
That homesteading, that farming in this huge section of the midsection of the United States had been a failure, had been a mistake. And we were going to move people out for the first. They had relocation, you know, federal relocation committees, et cetera. That's a huge thing to acknowledge, that you screwed up. Government had induced him to come there, and now you're acknowledging this failure. So you can hear in that speech Roosevelt saying, no, we will fight them. You know, we're going to – there's also a little bit of hubris in there that, you know, thinking you can restore this utter, you know, destruction that you've just put in there. Now, as it would apply to Obama, he has said, and Mitt Romney made fun of him, you know, I want to heal the rising seas. That became a talking point right up until Hurricane Sandy. And then suddenly it didn't look like a funny thing anymore. Obama was afraid of it because of coal mining constituencies in Ohio. It really was no more complex. Ohio and Pennsylvania. There's, you know, coal is the number one contributor to CO2 gas, the quickest thing. And, you know, we have it in our state and we're dealing with it. Can Obama make a similar thing? He's a gifted orator. He certainly knows he could do that. He has people around him who know it and can frame it in the narrative way. He doesn't have to run again. So he has nothing to worry about on that sense. He doesn't have to worry about the coal states. The difference there is, FDR not only made that speech, but then for the next 5 years tried to restore the land, sent thousands of workers out there teaching them how to till a different way, planting trees. Steve, they planted 220 million trees from the north to the south. They literally
– the rise of the Extension Service. You wrote about that.
Right. So they sent all these people out under the first attempt by the United States ever to restore a massive piece of land that they'd screwed up with. And the results were wrong. But that's to your question. Obama could make the speech, what is part two? What's the restoration part of it?
Yeah. Yeah. What do you make of where we stand in politics with Obama right now? Not with the fiscal cliff specifically, but it may tell us whether he's going to take on climate change, whether he will do immigration. What does he have to do in the next, what are we at, 6 weeks, five mm-hmm. weeks now?
He could start framing it now up until the State of the Union, which could be a peak thing in framing it right now. He has to start framing it. He hasn't done that at all. What helped Obama, what helped people who think we should look at this issue as the rest of the world is starting to look at it, was a storm.
Yeah.
And every time I write about it, the more and more and the older I get, I'm struck by this common similar theme of nature batting last. I wrote a column called Nature Votes Last.
Yeah.
It's amazing how Sandy changed everything.
It changed the narrative.
It changed that. You couldn't make fun of it anymore. Half of the Republican Party thought it was a hoax. You could go on the air and you could say, call a press conference and call it a hoax, and reasonable people would agree with you. You can't do that anymore. So that's changed rather quickly. So now, to your question, what could Obama do? Could he start saying, we'll never produce coal anymore? We're going to not let the XL pipeline in? The pipeline certainly would be symbolic, largely. You know, there's problems with that in BC, of course. It's not just an American thing. So he could do the pipeline. He could also start talking about coal. And he could also, if he wants to earn the Nobel Peace Prize he got for doing nothing 4 years ago, he got just for being elected, basically. And that's not my opinion. That's what happened. He could start to be a leader on this issue. Will he?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's the question. Will he? Do you look at what's happening in – we talked to somebody the other day. Oh, Mark Bowden. Mm-hmm. He was quoted as saying, you know, this whole Benghazi thing, in the end, it's just politics. It's just, as Cokie Roberts said this morning, the Republicans wanting to grab onto something so they can say we're still strong on international defense and national defense. Is it going to be more, do you think, this Benghazi thing, or blow around?
The one side, they've called it Obama's Watergate. I don't see any parallel to that at all. It's not even comparable to lying about weapons of mass destruction. The worst I can see here is that they did lie through the talking points. Did Susan Rice, Susan Rice, the ambassador to the UN, was she instructed to go out and say what she'd already been told was not true? Or did they do it to protect their intelligence?
Do you think extremist is a hiding word instead of terrorists?
I mean,
is that semantics, right, or is it more?
I agree with your earlier assessment that the fact that this has blown up somewhat is only because it happened right before election politics, and he had a pretty good foreign policy. He still has a pretty good foreign policy. He outflanked them on the right by saying, I've killed all the leaders of al-Qaeda, and suddenly they got, you know, this horrible tragedy. I really think it's a relatively minor thing.
Yeah. All right. All right. What's next, by the way? I mean, you're writing in the Opinionator. You have the Dust Bowl. Right. You can watch yourself on television tonight.
I know. Well, I'd like to think that the Dust Bowl story is one that people are going to incorporate into their sense of America. I mean, one of my pet peeves about this is when I started working on it and had several holy cow moments. I couldn't believe that this thing isn't even taught in schools. So my kid's high school history book had it as a single paragraph. This is the AP history team, Steve, in Seattle Public. Worst environmental catastrophe of our time. Biggest displacement of Americans until Hurricane Katrina. At the worst economic collapse. And it merits one paragraph in the AP history book. That has changed. And I think...
Wait, is that right? Ouch.
That's correct, yes. And I
one
think
paragraph?
That, yeah. And again, what happened here was... Steinbeck got the initial narrative, which was that they all went to California.
Yeah.
Or all came to Washington State, which was the second biggest recipient of people from Oklahoma and those areas.
Wow. All right. Tim Egan, we can watch Tim Egan and Ken Burns tonight at 10, part two of the Dust Bowl. You can read Tim Egan's book about it, The Worst Hard Times, which won the National Book Award, and his latest book, which we talked about just a few weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
This is Weekday.
Yesler Terrace is Seattle's oldest housing project. It was also the first to be racially integrated in the U.S. But taking Yesler Terrace from concept to realization was no easy task.
Public housing was new. It was considered radical. It was considered different. In some circles, it was considered communistic. There were those who said the federal government has no business being engaged in the housing business.
We'll explore the history of Yesler Terrace and the radical roots of public housing. That comes your way this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from GET, Washington's Guaranteed Education Tuition Program, helping parents plan and save for college with flexible options, a nationwide choice of colleges, and backed by the state of Washington. Information and online enrollment at get.wa.gov.
Cloudy skies and heavy rain in Seattle, 51 degrees right now in the U-District. Forecast calls for clouds and showers all day, the high in the low 50s. It's going to be cloudy, rainy, and windy tonight and tomorrow. Tonight's low 47, tomorrow's high reaching 51.
Support for KUOW comes from TIAA CREF, helping people pursue their financial goals. Learn more at tiaacref.org/WA.
The 2007 legislature created a joint task force on basic education finance to review the definition of basic education and all current basic education funding formulas. The task force is supposed to develop options for a new funding structure. Why are we talking about education funding? Because, as you know, the two gubernatorial candidates ran on the fact that the state Supreme Court has once again said that the state is not amply funding education as per the Constitution. And the McCleary decision suggests funding for schools might need to increase by $1 billion a year. We've been talking about some of those numbers and what amply funding education might mean in Washington State. Margaret Rosa is research associate professor at the University of Washington and a faculty member at Georgetown University. She studies these issues. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So one thing is you emailed me after I had when we did this conversation a week and a half ago with Diane Ravitch. And I was using 2006 numbers. And you said, well, it's gone up. It's changed a little bit. So where are we at now in terms of per pupil funding in Washington State?
So the last solid number we have on Washington State is from the 2009 school year. And it takes a couple years before the numbers come out. And that is at $9,500 per pupil. It's probably a little over $10,000 now on average. And we know that different school districts spend different amounts.
Because they have the ability to raise their rates, their levies locally and because...
Well, for several reasons. For one, our state funding formula doesn't fund a fixed amount per student. So we have higher spending in Washington State on some rural isolated districts, and that's because we fund a mix of ingredients into schools, and they would get a higher mix of ingredients given they have a smaller population. And so some of our rural and isolated districts are some of our highest spending districts. And then some different districts have historically grandfathered in limits to their local levy. So in our state, we have a limit on how much you can raise locally for the sake of equity. But a few places have some higher amounts on that. And then lastly, the federal government gives out different amounts of money for higher needs school districts and others.
And where's special ed money fit into this formula, this 94-52?
So the federal government and the state government give out some money for special ed, and a lot of districts kick in some of their own money for special ed as well.
And real quickly, why are rural districts getting more money? Because it's more expensive to educate fewer students? Is it economies of scale thing?
Well, that is the theory that the state has used. And so they get larger amounts of money. But what's interesting about different states is they have different theories on that. And depending on the state may or may not overfund small or rural districts relative to other districts.
All right. So what does that mean in terms of where we rank in Washington State versus the rest of the country?
So we are on the lower spending side. We're 31st, given the last set of numbers. And it's nothing to brag about because that's kind of a plateau of states that are spending in the mid 9,000s per student. And then there are quite a few states that are spending more than we are. So there are a few states that are spending quite a bit less. California and Utah is sort of notoriously low.
Is there any correlation between the amount spent per pupil and their graduation rates?
Well, you know, they're hard to sort of align the numbers perfectly. But if you look on the Center for American Progress website, they've done a good job in each state of looking at spending across districts and comparing that to outcomes. And they actually adjust the spending based on the type of students you have. And what you find in most states is that it's like a scatter plot. There's very little relationship. And if you were to put a line in there to show whether or not, what the relationship is, you would find in most states a slightly upward sloping line so that districts with more funds do have ever so slightly better student outcomes. But it's not a great relationship at this point.
And will it matter, Marguerite Rosa, based on, you said population, but I mean, can we break it down? Many states have more rural populations versus more urban populations versus second language users. I mean, is there something comparable to our understanding of per pupil spending versus all the diversity of students that we can get? That's a very vague question.
Right. So if you look at the spending level, it's more correlated to the formulas we would create around it, not which then have some implied relationship to the mix of students in there. But in every state and across states, you'll find comparable districts, similar size, similar mix of kids, similar amount of kids who don't speak English. One might be spending more than another, and they might be getting the same results, or one is spending more and getting better results than the other, or one is spending less and getting better results than another. So that's where you start to feel this need to put the money spent, the spending, alongside the outcomes.
Right, which is why we end up with tests, among other things.
Tests and other things, right? Yeah. Because one of the things we know is that parents are a fairly decent force for accountability, and they will cry foul if there are no arts, and if the school isn't run in a thoughtful way, and the students don't have athletics and access to music and things like that.
So, Marguerite Rosa, what do you think then? What should we think about how the state is now grappling with this ruling by the Supreme Court, which again says the Constitution says you got to adequately fund, amply fund education? Well, what does that mean? What's that going to mean? When we talk about $1 billion a year more in education, I mean, spending more does not necessarily give us the outcomes we want.
Well, I think it's an opportunity to have asked the question both, you know, how can we increase spending, but how can we do it in a way that helps reestablish that link between spending and outcomes? How can we do it in a way so that when we do add more money to the system, we're actually on the other side getting a better system for it? Because there are many states have tried this where they added money and they didn't get a whole lot for it. They might have gotten a little bit better, you know, ever so slightly increased in outcomes. But the increased in spending right now, the way we have structured the system, is not a guarantee of a translation to results. So we have an opportunity to start to merge those questions of how will the money be used and what kind of system can we create so that as we add more funding, we'll get better results for it.
What system compares to ours in terms of around the world, in terms of spending per pupil, if one way to look at it, but gets much better outcomes?
Well, most of the international comparisons are actually not great comparisons. You mean a different country compared to Washington State or a different country compared to the United States? I mean, we're relatively high spending across across other countries, but many countries, you might say, wow, here's one, and that country doesn't have the same sort of diversity of student populations that we have. It may not have the same scale. It may not have the same sort of state control components that we have. So what I can tell you that Washington State is a good, you know, we can think about ourselves compared with other states around the country, because state funding is sort of a state issue. We get about 10% of our money from the federal government. But one thing, our state, we've gone heavily on state funding and really constrained local funding. And so we don't have the same problem other states have with real severe inequities with our suburbs. In fact, our suburbs tend to spend less than some of our urban centers. And, you know, Bellevue spends quite a bit less than Seattle. And if you, but there's also a downside to that, which is that voters are more likely to vote for local funds than they are to vote for state. So we've set ourselves up with a very heavily state-funded system, and it's becoming hard to get the revenue. And if we could figure out a way to harness the local money, we might see greater long-term growth in spending.
But you'd have to figure out a way to have it be equitable?
You have to figure out a way to have it be equitable, yes. And that's a definite challenge. I mean, there are ways that some states are experimenting with equalization funds and some contributions they could put back into the mix. But certainly with local voters, again, they're going to want to see that their funds are used thoughtfully in ways that are creating a better relationship with student outcomes.
All right. So that's the sort of the questions we can ask as we start looking at how to spend. Just a last question for you. What is the trend in Washington State, not in terms of funding, but in terms of success?
So we have some pockets of success. I mean, in some ways, you might say that we're fairly effective given our spending level, but we have some real pockets of failure, too. So we are not doing well with low-income minority populations, with students who don't speak English. We're also not doing well on science and math, and we know that, and we have some strong problems with that. In our state, we built a system that pays science teachers on average less than we pay all other teachers, and we've done that by focusing in really on longevity and master's degrees, and ignoring sort of the market rates for people with science degrees and things like that. So we are underproducing science talent in this state.
All right, your magic wand. Three things you would start with to try to shift to better outcomes.
Well, one, I would try to sort of merge the conversations in accountability, innovation, and things like that, and funding. And right now, those are separate committees at the state level, and that's too bad. They should be put together. Second, I would try to harness the talent inside our system in Washington State. We're a state filled with people who are nimble and adept at change and willing to try change, except we have a school system that we say doesn't need any change. So I would look inside that system and ask the people in the system to help craft the solutions. But that means we've got to loosen the constraints on the system. We can't say that every classroom has to be the same size, every teacher has to be the same amount, every delivery model has to be the same if we want to see that innovation grow in our own state. And I think I did three.
You did three.
Okay.
Whether we can get all those things accomplished is another. All right. Well, okay. Shall we check back?
Yes, I would love
numbers
that.
Clear.
Numbers are clear now. All right. Yes.
Margaret Rosa is a University of Washington professor, also going to Georgetown, teaching there as well, through the magic of the of new technologies.
Through the magic of new technologies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
We have clouds and heavy rain, 51 degrees in Seattle. Forecast calls for clouds and showers the rest of today, the high in the low 50s. The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch for many parts of western Washington through tomorrow afternoon. It's going to be cloudy, rainy, and windy tonight and tomorrow. Tonight's low 47, tomorrow's high reaching 51.
Support for KUOW comes from TherapySearch.net, a place to turn when making the important decision of choosing a counselor, providing information to help those seeking counseling make educated choices and find psychotherapists who meet their needs. On the web at TherapySearch.net.
The Chinese have a whole new leadership team, a clean slate, a fresh start, kind of.
You know, Chinese are very obedient people, very indulgent of their leaders, up to a certain point. Beyond that point, they are bad business.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the lessons of history from a guy who was there. It's next time on Marketplace from APM.
That story and much more are coming up tonight at 6:30. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 10:35.
Now we're going to look at Thanksgiving for a few minutes. You may need some help. So, Carrie Sears here, executive chef at Art Restaurant and Lounge, director of food and beverage at the Four Seasons Hotel, Seattle. Good to see you again, sir.
Nice to see you.
By the way, you know, I have a friend who knows you. We're talking. Kenyatta Carter is head chef at the Southern Soul Food Restaurant, Kingfish Cafe on Capitol Hill. She's cooking all sorts of food, though, from Mediterranean to French cuisine. Good to see you again.
Hey, good to see you.
All right, what's your side dish? What's your side dish for Thanksgiving? I've asked you this, I think, every year.
Every year. I'm going controversial by not doing candied yams this year.
That's fine. Are you going to do anything with yams?
You know what? I'm going to stick with my sweet potato pie. We'll be doing greens and a big dish of roasted vegetables like beets and squash and Brussels sprouts and things like that.
What's your side dish?
So the classics.
Candied yams.
We got candied yams. We've got mashed potatoes. We've got carrots. We've added kale because kale is a vegetable of this year. So.
It's a fine vegetable. How are you going to cook your kale?
Just stew it down.
Uh-huh.
A little bit of olive oil.
What are you doing with greens? Collard greens?
Yeah, collard greens, the usual. Cooking it down with a little smoked turkey tails and onion and garlic and a little spice to it.
Mmm.
Yep. Always good.
What are you doing with your kale?
Very similar.
Yeah.
No smoked turkey, though. We keep it vegetarian.
For those folks.
Yeah. We got big numbers. We got to try to appease everybody.
Okay. Why no candied yams?
I just felt like, oh, again. It's like, oh, I feel like the sweet yams. And then it's like, oh, now the sweet pie. I mean, I may go back to doing the yams, but maybe just a roasted yam, like almost like a baked potato with a little like sweet and sour cream and brown sugar, but not the full-on candied yams, because I think the pie is just a little bit overwhelming.
But it's good.
Mm. Yeah.
What are you making for dessert? Or do you assign that to someone else?
We have Tara, who's our pastry chef, and we've had pumpkin pie on all month. She's done a different version. She's actually done it deconstructed and served in a jam jar, which is a lot of fun. So,
wait a minute.
Yeah.
Hold the phone.
Yeah, please. Yeah, there's still all the ingredients there, but she's actually, you know, the mason jar. That's a very popular.
Yes.
Instead of doing pie pastry, she made parmiers, which is like a puff dough, which is caramelized in sugar and baked, and so that's on the bottom with the pumpkin pie mix and then a big dollop of cinnamon whipped cream on top, served in the jar, and you can just mix it up or go each layer and layer. So.
That sounds good.
It's good stuff.
The palmiers.
Yeah.
That's a good food.
Yeah, it's got a nice crunch.
All right. Then, and people will have questions for you. So our number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. If you have some Thanksgiving questions, you want some tips, you have some ingredients, you want a little consultation. Carrie Sears here. Kenyatta Carter here. 206-543-5869. 1-800-289-5869. I think this was actually all things considered. Alton Brown was talking about dressing, stuffing. And he does not stuff the bird because it takes too long to cook, and then you can't match the stuffing consistency. He was arguing with the bird's consistency, and you don't want a dry turkey, and to get the stuffing done, you don't want undercooked turkey mm-hmm. to have the stuffing right. He shoves a number 10 can inside the turkey.
As you would do.
As you would
do. Number 10 can of what? Yeah.
Empty, you know, yeah. clean.
That's empty good. Or full.
And, you know, ends on taken out on both sides. You guys don't do that, do you?
No.
I had never heard that before.
Is that a sort of take on beer can chicken?
No. He puts the number 10 can in there, I think, in part for this reason. So he cooks the bird, gets it perfect. He cooks his dressing out of the bird, gets it perfect. And then he shoves the dressing into the turkey using the number 10 can as a sort of mold. Then he pulls the can out, leaving the dressing in there. Then he lets the bird sit for 15 minutes, at which point it absorbs all the flavors of the turkey. So you get that at the same time. And then he takes a blowtorch and he blowtorches the end of the...
He's only cooking one turkey. I'm cooking 56 turkeys, so
yeah,
I'm not going to do that.
Blowtorch that hangs out, you know, right by my stove.
I don't know about the blowtorch.
How do you do... Wow. I just thought it was an elaborate four-stage process that I enjoyed. How do you do dressing?
Wow, I wish I was a little bit more dramatic. Yeah.
Actually, yes, we have this huge big pot we make with brioche croutons and sage and Italian chestnuts, and we make the big mix in the tilt skillet, and then this year actually doing them individually. Last year I did them in rolls and sliced them, but we do it separately. We don't stuff the turkeys with it. We actually break our turkeys down for ease of cooking, and
you do?
Yeah, we confit the legs and things like that. So, you know, butter underneath the skin of the breast. So, but they're all going to be done this time in silpats, which are the flexi pads. So they're going to be like a little muffin, almost like a little individual sage and onion chestnut stuffing muffin.
Little, when you say silpats, you mean like a muffin cup?
Well, yeah, silpats are these flexi pads, which are spin-off from the space.
Yes.
Aeronautic industry.
I believe I've poached an egg in one.
There you go. And that's what we're going to do. So they just pop out so we don't have to use tons of oil and everything on that. So that's how we're going to make all our individual stuffing.
What is it to confit a turkey leg?
We're going to cook it in duck fat and grapeseed oil.
For how long?
It's a couple of hours. Really slow.
How low? Like what with the temperature?
Just so it's simmering. You just got that little adulation in the oil. And then you take them out.
Is it on the stovetop?
On the stovetop.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, just covered. And then we'll take them out and then roast them very high heat, get them nice and crispy.
Like 475 or something.
As high as it goes.
Oh, yeah, crank it up. Just blast it.
Yeah, we'll blast it.
Wow.
Not a blowtorch.
No, I don't bring out a blowtorch. Blowtorch is when you're really in trouble.
You sure you don't have one just lying about in your
We have them. Flamethrower.
Yeah, I see on those cooking shows that you use blowtorches all the time.
Well, the little ones.
The little one.
Envisioning like a big one.
With an acetylene tank.
Backpack.
Some weight.
All right, what are you doing for your dressing?
Well, luckily,
yes?
I have it easy. I'm just cooking for my family. So, yeah, usually I get a whole bunch of cornbread muffins, and I crumble them up to make my dressing.
Where do you get the cornbread muffins?
Oh, from work. Luckily, I get to make them, too, so I'll make them. And, you know, they have a little green chili mixed into them already, a little whole corn, and they're really rich and creamy. But
do you like them to sit for a couple days to dry out?
Yeah, I just put them overnight. I crumble it up and then put it overnight in the oven to dry them out so it can absorb as much.
Is the oven just the oven, the warmth of the oven from the pilot light?
No, it doesn't really need it. The pilot light's enough for me
and
enough for that. So, yeah, I'll cook up a little, you know, celery, onion, some fresh sage from the yard, and, you know, some bell peppers and a little bit of roasted turkey stock over that, and a little couple of pats of butter on top to get it a little crispy on top.
How long does it cook?
About 35, 40 minutes. Not too long.
How long do those muffin size?
They go really quick. They're about 20 minutes or so. But the thing is, you make them a few days in advance. I think it's important to make stuffing ahead of time.
So it absorbs the
flavors. Oh, yeah.
You
got to marry those flavors in there. And then you put the high heat on. Bake them off.
By the way, you're making Thanksgiving at Four Seasons or at Art. Where are you making 56 turkeys?
Well, this year we're actually doing Art, of course, for Thanksgiving. And then we're also opened up our ballroom. Oh. So we're doing a buffet up in the ballroom for $45 for larger groups. We really wanted to get that family feel. So we've got a 16 top, you know, 10 top. So you just go up there and it's kind of, you don't have to do dishes. You don't have to clean up. And just go and have a good time. Kids area and all that
stuff. Is it Did it sell well?
We've got a few spaces. So if there's anybody out there with six and up, we will add a few people. We've got a big ballroom. So
how many people is that going
to
be?
Well, we're hoping about 150 to 200. We're about 140 right now. But if they keep coming, the 200, we'll open it up.
So never complain about the number of people you're cooking dinner for.
Yeah.
Oh, imagine if there was 100 people in your family.
Oh, man. No. 56 turkeys?
56 turkeys.
Where do you get your turkeys from?
Actually, they were coming out of Oregon.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Organic, non-organic, farm?
Yeah, they're organic, as they call them, organic.
Yeah, right.
Tom turkeys, yeah.
All right. So. Wow. 56 turkeys.
That is where it cut out from.
All right. Oh, you can also email us with questions, too. I got a couple of questions here and some callers as well. If you're getting ready for Thanksgiving, you have some questions or thoughts or just flavors you're curious about. I have some flavors I'm curious about. But Nancy writes, what are your favorite ingredients to put in a cranberry chutney? Do you make a cranberry chutney?
Yeah.
What do you like?
I use mandarin oranges, cinnamon sticks. I put a couple of jalapenos in there just to give it a little bit of bite. I'll take them out later, but you know, get that sweet and sour.
When do you make it?
We made it last week.
So you let it sit. Same thing, marrying the flavors.
Marrying the flavors.
How about yourself?
I like golden raisins, cinnamon clove, a little bit of zest, like orange and lemon zest mixed in, and maybe sometimes a little apple.
A little apple?
Yeah.
And do you also like it to sit for a bit?
Yeah, I made it last week, too.
You made it last week already.
And I canned a few little jars so people can take it home with them.
And this is just for your family.
I know.
Nice.
You're good people. You are good people. I'm trying to adapt a recipe for rosemary smoked bird from a charcoal grill to a gas grill. What adjustments should I make? This is from Rob. All right, so he was going to smoke the turkey on a charcoal grill, nice, and do it on a gas grill.
Well, I think you could use, if you're using any kind of wood chip, I mean, I'm using some bourbon barrel chips for my prime rib smoking. I'm sure that would go lovely with your bird. You could also, when you have your chips in your little smoker box or something, you could put a few sprigs of fresh rosemary in there, and that'll probably permeate your bird a little bit easier without getting too harsh.
So on a gas grill, where do you just put the chips? You have a box, or do you just put them on the grill?
In like a skillet. If you've got a heavy cast iron skillet or something, or even a cut tin, can.
Perhaps a tin.
There you go. We'll go back to number 10. But something that you're not too passionate about, and you just put the soaked chips on there. It's probably easier on a gas grill because you can regulate the heat a lot easier. So.
Or you could do a really thick tin foil, and just poke a few holes in it, and then you could have a few standing by, and if you need a little bit more extra smoke, you could just throw another one on the grill.
Grilling seems to be...
It's replaced deep frying?
We've been on air, 20 minutes? It's the first time we talked about deep frying. Usually we go a lot quicker on that one. But grilling is the deep frying of the 2010.
Carrie Sear is executive chef of Art, Restaurant, and Lounge, director of food and beverage at the Four Seasons Hotel in Seattle. Kenyetta Carter is the head chef of the Southern Soul Food Restaurant, Kingfish Cafe, which makes so many excellent things. Oh, by the way, our number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. If you have some questions, some thoughts about flavors. Please have the guests explain about making the stuffing ahead. That's from Alicia. Making it ahead in that you want the flavors to marry, you were saying.
Yeah. So I'll just do a quick basic recipe. Of course, you've got onions and sage, chestnuts. So those would be sweated off. We had some celery. And when I said put them in a fry pan, you just sweat them. You don't want to get any color on them, so it's kind of a medium heat, a little bit of olive oil or grapeseed oil. And then, of course, you'll have breadcrumbs. I like to use some nice leftover stale breadcrumbs, chicken stock or turkey stock. But usually we use chicken stock because we haven't got our turkeys in yet. And sage and salt, pepper, and just... Then when the onions add the stock, you make all that wet liquid, then combine that with your breadcrumbs and then mix them all together. And then you can either put them in a bowl or we roll them in parchment paper and foil paper and then put them in the fridge and let them sit. But in the muffin tins, you can pack them in the muffin tins as well. So you want it, that's how we kind of, my grandmother used to add sausage meat to it as well, just as you're frying those onions up, you break up some of those English bangers and put the sausage meat in there, and that gives you a nice flavoring.
And do you add the stock later on, or do you?
I add, when you add your onions and sage and everything with your breadcrumbs, then I add the hot stock over to the bread, and you get this kind of big mushy mess and everything. Yes. Yeah, it's really great. Get your hands in there, and we have this huge bowl which you could bath about 10 babies in it. And that's where we mix all that up in there wearing gloves, and then we roll them and pack them up.
Do you do that?
Oh, yeah, pretty much.
Except for the big ball.
Saute up all my onions and everything and toss it all together. If I'm a little bit ahead like I am like right now, I'll put a little layer of parchment and foil over the top. And then right before I cook it, I'll add my hot turkey stock and then, let it finish baking that way.
Because you want more bread? You want more bread texture?
Yeah, yeah.
Look,
like
rather.
A little drier in my household. They just like a little drier.
Didn't people used to talk about – I seem to remember – people talking about putting oysters into stuffing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I did it once.
And you didn't
just
like
once.
It?
It wasn't me. I thought it was very creative moving to Seattle, and it was my first year. I thought, okay, great. You know, in the Pacific Northwest, oysters, it was a lynching. Don't mess with stuffing. It was just like, don't put oysters in it. It's a classic, you know. Just. I should have done a choice.
My thing. I think it's more of an East Coast
thing. I think so, too.
Yeah. Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
All right, here. We got one question for you on brining. I'm concerned about my mother who's on a low-salt diet for heart issues. Can I still brine my turkey, or will that add salt to the bird?
I will add salt to the bird, but usually at the end of the brining process, you are going to rinse it off. You're going to rinse it a little bit underwater. You might want to rinse it a little bit harder and make sure you pat it dry.
And in terms of deep frying, why has it fallen by the wayside? You suppose? Have you talked to people? Is it just too hard?
Oil and water do not mix.
Yeah. I think finally where we live.
We've learned that.
Well, also, you know, it, like with most things with food trend, when you have to buy a specific piece of equipment, it usually does fall by the wayside fairly quickly.
All right. I see. When did you first start celebrating Thanksgiving? What year? Do you remember?
Oh,
because there is, of course, you know, there is the accent which tells me.
Well, in England, it's Harvest Festival, so it's always been a food related thing with Harvest Festival.
Similar foods?
No turkey, but we used to do a rooster and corn and things like that. Because it was the end of the harvest for the farmers. That was where the whole.
And that was it for the rooster at that point.
That was it for the rooster, yeah. And we also have that at Christmas as well. Cockerel, we call them over in the UK. But then it was my first Thanksgiving would have been in Canada when I came over in the 70s. So, but
it doesn't count. Thanksgiving.
No. But then the U.S. was.
It's Canadians alone.
Well, all right. So is it a meaningful holiday for you? I mean, is it an important holiday for you, Kenyatta?
Yeah, I think so. I love, I mean, I know it's our job to do cooking every day, so you would think it's like just another day for us, but it's one of the few times I really can actually get together with my family all at once, and we have the things we love, and, you know, we could talk about the past and the many disasters and triumphs of Thanksgivings, and, you know, it's just... there's no pressure, as with Christmas. There are always gifts involved and, you know, a lot of shuttling of people back and forth and where are you going to be. But Thanksgiving seems to be such a nice, relaxing holiday.
For you? You have to work.
I have to work. I just say, why not come to a hotel or go out to a restaurant and take all that stress away and have a great time with family. So.
All right. Have a great time. We got some good email questions in there. I appreciate you guys coming in. Kenyatta Carter. Carrie Sear,
you're welcome.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Turkey Day.
Happy Turkey Day. This is Weekday. President Obama has made a landmark visit to Burma, urging the country's leadership to take more steps toward democratic reform. Speaking in Burma just today, the president used the name of the country that its leaders use, Myanmar, at least once. When he spoke at the university, he didn't name the country, but he told students assembled they had a lot more work to do to bring democracy to their country. Our weekday bicycle correspondent, Willie Weir, and his wife, Kat Mariner, they've been pedaling through Myanmar, and they were in Yangon for the president's arrival. I asked Willie to describe how the city had prepared for the visit.
The streets were closed off very early in the morning and remained so for the entire time the president was here. A little difficult to get around the city. It just so happened that the guest house that Kat and I were staying at was a very short walk away from one of the main routes, and the route that President Obama and Hillary came in with an entourage. People lined up the streets, and there were some American flags and American T-shirts, a couple of Obama T-shirts that I saw that I'm sure had just recently been printed. People have been talking about it for weeks. In fact, we heard about it from two kids in Bagan who were at a hotel that were there that said, your president's coming to our country, and we thought that they were just kidding, and it wasn't until 2 days later that we read it on the Internet that, yes, he was coming.
What kind of reaction have people had? They're excited?
Oh, very excited. Very excited. Every time you mention you're from America, even before his visit was announced, people would always say, Obama, Obama. So he's a very, very popular here. And I think that for the people here being acknowledged, and also an acknowledgement of the changes that are happening in the country. And, you know, for us, it's a little difficult to understand the change because we haven't been here before, but we've talked to friends and also from, of course, people who live here, that the changes have been really dramatic. Everything from Internet access to people being able to speak out freely to the fact that Aung San Suu Kyi, that her image is everywhere. It's in calendars. It's in posters. It's in every single city and little village that you go through in this country. And as of 2 years ago, you would not have seen her image. People might have had hidden away somewhere. So things are changing so very quickly. And there is a lot of excitement.
But what kind of country have you found in those villages and on those dusty roads and in the towns? Are people in cars? Are they in carts? What's the technology like?
Well,
what's the agriculture
in
like?
Speaking of how the changes, of course, when you go off into the rural areas, ox carts are being used everywhere in the fields. A lot of manual hand labor from, you know, building roads. We are literally watching roads being built by hand, rock by rock, tar being scooped in by bucketfuls on the road to repave in certain areas. At the same time, you'll have a very, very expensive car, flash by. There are more cars. There are more, products coming into the country. People are excited about that, and of course there's a lot of changes that will be coming over the next months. As a traveler, just simple things like going to exchange money. Anybody who's been here before for many years realizes that you had to arrive into Myanmar with perfect money, the meaning looked like it just came off the printing press. Those things are starting to change. The fact that now you can actually exchange money in the bank. The rate between the bank and the street used to be almost 100, almost 400 to 1. Now you can get almost the same rate in the bank as you would get from somebody on the street. So many things, and of course, those are things as a traveler. But for the people, and I would say probably in the cities, things are going to change much faster and much slower out in the villages, and of course in the areas that are far away from those centers, and also the areas where there still is conflict, change is going to be a long time coming.
Willie Ware was talking to us from Yangon, Myanmar, where he has been bicycling around the country. They ended up there on the same day as President Obama came to that country and gave a speech, moved on to Cambodia now. Willie moves on with Kat to Thailand, where they'll bike along the eastern part of that country. He's been sending us sounds of the day and posting at Yellow Tent Adventures his stories. You can check those out at yellowtentadventures.com. We have a link usually when we have one of Willie's sounds of the day, and we'll have more from him and more sounds in the days ahead. What a whirlwind of a show. I don't know if I've stopped yet. We started with Hostess bankruptcy, and we ended with Myanmar. Andy Hirsch is our engineer. He took us along for the ride. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Bagano, Amina Alsadi, Alexander Garrettin, and Daniel Anthony Goodwin, our interns. I'm Steve Scher. Tomorrow, we'll talk about pies for Thanksgiving. We'll also talk about strife in the Gaza Strip. Do join us. Oh, we also want your Thanksgiving horror and happiness stories to kick off the holiday. Do join us.
Good morning. It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next. The following is a required weekly test of the emergency alert system. Has been a required weekly test of the emergency alert system.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, featuring 1,400 channels of on-demand entertainment at every seat. Non-stop flights to Dubai depart from Seattle daily. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.